Good evening. This is TNT Radio, brought to you by Bloggin Broadcasting Service, and I'm Nevin Campanella, your net reporter. Have you had a wonderful day today? I hope you have, because guess what, folks? I have had a wonderful day. I mean, absolutely fantastic. PBS Radio is performing at top speed. I guess you might say something like a super fast Porsche, doing well on a highway, zipping along at about 140, and knowing no boundaries. We are doing it, folks. PBS Radio is getting together. And for those who are looking for archives, almost all the archives have been uploaded. They are now being defined. My guess is, and you can take it from me, within a couple days, you ought to be able to go into the archives and find past shows. Well, how tough is it to get a studio together? Well, we are at step one. Step one. We are just beginning. And you would be amazed at what is required. I mean, it boggles the mind. But it is getting there. It is absolutely getting there. We have a lot of things going on. We've got a great cooperative cast of show hosts. By the way, the show hosts are now getting together, and there's going to be a phone conference. They're taking ideas from each other. They're looking at all ideas. The objective is going to be to put together an AM format. Now, my good buddy Scott in Omaha, I hope you're listening, Scott. We'll really appreciate this. He sent me a wonderful letter with a number of really excellent links on how to do this. And so we are now implementing what Scott has sent me from Omaha, Nebraska. By the way, that's Robin Valley AM Radio out of Omaha, Nebraska. And for a little bit more information about Scott, he also raises homing pigeons. Actually, that's how I first met him years ago on the net. I became interested in raising homing pigeons, got in touch with Scott, and he kind of got me started. And Jill and I began raising white Belgian pigeons. As a matter of fact, we may do that here in Paradise. It would be beautiful watching those beautiful birds fly through the trees. Don's children would certainly love it. Well, the broadcasting schedule, what's going to happen, it's all very exciting. I am truly excited about this. The format is actually being developed. And once the conferencing is over, the show hosts will submit their ideas to me, and we will try to put a package together. Basically, what it comes down to is net radio has always been kind of a catch-as-catch-can system. In other words, you get on a stream, do your own thing, and start talking into a microphone. The devil may care as to how long, what you're saying, or anything else. Well, you know, it's kind of okay. I mean, there really is nothing wrong with that. But, and this is a big but, folks, if you want to get involved with AM affiliates, now what does that mean? That means the shows that we produce actually get picked up by AM or FM radio. Well, in order to do that, you have to have a format that fits what they're doing. So, in the very near future, the formats of the shows will change. And at the top of the hour, what you're going to hear when you first listen is you're going to hear about a six-minute opening, which will include such things as a little bit of opening music, possibly, but primarily somebody on a microphone, most likely me, doing a little news reporting, some commercials, and then an introduction of the next show. That's where I'm hoping to get to. Once that little six-minute slot is taken care of, the show host will be introduced, and they will go to the bottom of the hour. Now, at the bottom of the hour, there will be an official break for all shows, for all of them, and that will be a four-minute break, which will also include such things as maybe a little news update, but probably more promos for the shows and some commercials. And then they go to almost the end of the hour. Now, I say almost because once they get to the end of the hour, a 1 minute and 10 seconds prior to the end of the hour, a song will start. And it will be the icon song of BBS Radio. It'll be the closing song for a show. I don't really know what it'll be yet, but it'll take 1 minute and 10 seconds, and it will slowly fade out. And that's how the show host will know their time is over. That particular musical piece, that 1 minute, 10 seconds, believe it or not, is extremely important because it kind of runs the clock. But also, listen carefully to this one, eventually people around the planet will start recognizing that theme that we play. And that particular theme will be selected by the chairman of BBS Radio and chairman of Blogin Service, who is Don Newsom. Don will select the music for that. Okay, so where are we at? This day in history. Let me tell you, folks, March 29th in history has a very strange twist to it. One of the particular events that took place in 1951, I'm going to do a whole section on right after I finish March 29th in history. But let me get to it. Hey, you remember the movie War of the Roses? Oh, I love that movie. I thought it was great. You know, the end of it was kind of sad. You got to ask yourself, would people actually bring it that far? When you got a husband and wife who wind up dead on the floor because they could not find a way to communicate except through battles. They eventually killed each other. That's how the movie ends. However, there actually was a War of the Roses in 1461. Now, this was when Edward of York defeated Queen Margaret to become King Edward IV of England. In 1638, on March 29th, Swedish colonists established the first settlement in Delaware called New Sweden. Now, you got to picture this, folks. You know, right now, you're sitting at your computer, you're listening to this person over this marvelous net system broadcasting a radio, and you're looking maybe through a window looking at cities and towns and wondering if you should go to the market tonight to buy dinner or possibly go out to a restaurant or maybe to a show. What was it like in 1638 on March 29th, right where you live, right where you live? Just imagine how primitive. And when I use the word primitive, I guess I shouldn't use that word. Maybe what I mean is how beautiful, how natural, the natural beauty of the land. It had not been touched. Think about it. You're looking out the window. Now think back to 1638. What do you see? In your particular part of the country, what would have been there? Would there have been trees? Would there have been rivers and little brooks? Would there have been animals running through the brush? Think about it in 1630, what this country looked like. And that was the first settlement in Delaware called New Sweden. An interesting thing about names from the old world to the new world. I was born and raised in Newark, New Jersey. You know, the name Newark was really a slang of New Ark. That's what it was originally named. Over time, as usual with us humans, we take an easy road, and instead of New Ark, it became Newark. Interesting, huh? I look out, and I'll tell you this about Paradise, California. I'm looking at a reflection right now in a picture that's up in front of me, and the glass in front is reflecting out the double glass doors. I'm telling you, folks, it is absolutely beautiful here. I could almost imagine right now this place, except for the few houses that dot the top of the canyon, probably was very similar 300-400 years ago. I mean, it is still that beautiful here. It really is. No, I don't want you moving here. Stay away. Come and visit, but don't move here. Okay, 1799, on March 29th, very fascinating Northeast law. You got to remember, folks, that with the passage of this law, and I'm talking about 1799, not 1865. You're already guessing, right? 66 years before the Civil War, New York passes a law aimed at gradually abolishing slavery in the state. And on March 29th, 1865, there was a battle. Appomattox Courthouse. What a battle. I mean, folks, what happened in the Civil War, you know, when you see war now, what you see is people pushing buttons. During the Civil War, people were just stabbing and hacking each other to death. That's what was happening. Now, on March 29th, another significant thing happened in 1936. Keep this in mind, because what I'm about to read to you is starting to happen now in the United States. 1936, March 29th, in Germany, dictator Hitler received 99% of the votes in a referendum to ratify Germany's illegal reoccupation of the Rhineland, receiving 44.5 million votes out of 45.5 million registered voters. Now, keep in mind that in 1933, all political parties and political liberty had been abolished. It's the next one I'm going to read that took place in 1951 that still generates confusion and questions. On March 29th, in 1951, Ethel and Julius Rosenberg were convicted of conspiracy to commit espionage. Do the names sound familiar to you folks? You know, this was during the McCarthy era and so on and so forth. Well, let me tell you, that particular conviction, which, by the way, ended in their death. I mean, they were executed. Is still being argued today. And I'm going to get into that right after I finish the what happened in history. 1961. Wonderful day in history. March 29th, 1961. Finally, the people of Washington, D.C. could vote in a presidential election. Could you believe it? Prior to that, they could not. They actually had to amend the Constitution. The 23rd Amendment had to be ratified, and it allowed then residents of Washington, D.C. to vote in presidential elections. Now, 1973. This was a good day in history. This was a good day. March 29th, 1973. The last United States soldier left South Vietnam. We got out of it. How did we get out? Well, you know, there's an old saying, don't throw good money after bad. Finally, what we did was we stopped tossing the money. We stopped the war. We walked out of it. It was a mistake. It was a mistake to begin with. It never should have gotten to the level that it did. Never. You can blame. I mean, I guess you'd go back and look at Kennedy and start with the blame to him. But the simple fact is that it was the vice president when he became president, Johnson, who made all the stupid, dumb mistakes. Vietnam was never a war that was ever intended to be won. It wasn't. It never was. And we finally did get out of it in 73. As I recall, 73 was also around that time, folks, that we had the, there were a number of things going on. Nixon was just, I think, getting accused of his wrongdoing, the whole Watergate thing. And, as I remember, and I don't have this in my notes, I'm just recalling, also there was the oil shortage, which had resulted from the OPEC nations getting together. I mean, that's what it amounted to, and they cut back production. I remember those days. I remember when people were standing in line trying to get gasoline. Those were tough days. But guess what? They could get tougher. And one last, I love this number. In 1999, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at 10,006.78. That's the first time in history it went above the 10,000 mark. It's been kind of a benchmark, and I'll tell you, folks, I had been involved with mutual funds going all the way back to the, maybe 1985, something like that, 84. And I remember taking a little bit of money that I had. I can't quite remember how it came to me, but I had kind of a bundle of money, not a whole lot. And I went to a particular brokerage firm, and I said, boy, you know, I need to do something with this. What should I do? At the time, the Dow Jones average was under 3,000. I think it was something like 26, 27, something like that. Well, I put the money in, and I started going to some of the meetings that they hold for people who have money invested. I just wanted to find out, you know, what's going on. I remember the first meeting I went to where the person conducting the meeting asked the audience, he said, do you think that it is ever possible for the Dow Jones average to get above 5,000? Well, hardly anybody raised their hand. I raised mine because I'm always for, yeah, let's go for it. Can you imagine what those people must be thinking today? I mean, actually, I think the Dow Jones has probably been as far as 11.4 or something like that. And you know, there isn't a number that can't be broken. So I think back to those years when people thought, oh, no, it can never do that, it can never do that. Look at it today. How far it went. Now, what is it based on, that Dow Jones Industrial Average? Are we really making money? Nope. It's all smoke and mirrors, folks. There is no money. There isn't any money. Nothing real as in terms of an exchange. I mean, money today is nothing but a number on a computer screen. The dollar bill you might have in your pocket is worth nothing more than a piece of paper it's printed on, if even that. You can't do anything with it. I mean, it's just a piece of paper. Now, at one time, there was actually something behind it, either gold, silver, whatever, something that carried weight. In other words, I got a pound of gold here. I don't want to carry it around, so I'm going to get these notes that say, yeah, I got this pound of gold. No more. That piece of paper is called trust. You trust that the next person you hand it to is going to take it. Weird, huh? Why would somebody accept, I don't know, $2 for a loaf of bread? You can eat the loaf of bread. What can you do with the paper? Hopefully pass it on to the next person, and hopefully they'll keep taking it. Will there come a time when they won't? That's why everybody's holding their breath. Okay, let's get now, that's the end of the history of March 29th. Now let's go back. I got to step back on this, folks, because it really is important. Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. Now the Rosenbergs went to trial, accused of stealing the secret of the atomic bomb and delivering it to the former USSR. Did they do it? Well, It was a long trial. Not all the information that should have come out came out, that's for sure. So now, instead of me just giving you my opinion, I'm going to read you some write-ups about it. And the very first one comes from a website called straightdope.com. A guy named Cecil writes this, and what he does is he does an intensive investigation on particular topics. And you can ask him, you know, just about any question. And he gets a lot of questions, and he'll pick one to do a massive research. Dear Cecil, give us the real scoop. Did the Venona Project establish beyond a doubt that Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, who were executed as spies in 1953, but proclaimed their innocence, were they Soviet agents? So Cecil replies. Now, he did, believe me, the man did his research because I know a little bit about the case. Quote, of the many revelations since the fall of the Iron Curtain, one of the least expected was that all that McCarthy-era Red Scare mongering wasn't pure paranoia. Now, I know a lot of you out there don't want to hear that, because I myself was a believer that most of it was just paranoia. But there was some truth. Now, this doesn't excuse what McCarthy did. McCarthy was a turkey. Now, he didn't care who he went after. But there was some truth. Now, case in point, the Rosenbergs, long considered victims of a frame-up based on secret Soviet cables decrypted as part of the Venona Project, as well as other evidence, the verdict of history, for now, is that they didn't deserve the chair. And Julius Rosenberg was way guiltier than his wife Ethel. But, yeah, they were spies. You know, that's one of the primary questions here. Not were they spies. They did, or at least Julius did. He was, in fact, actively engaged. And I'll get to that in a minute, because the head of the Soviet Union said so. But hold on for a second. These people were accused of passing information. Do you know how much information gets passed from one country to another by our own diplomats? They don't call it spying. They call it parlaying. Gee, I'll tell you this, if you tell me this. These people got executed for it. I mean, they fried in a chair, folks. You know, burnt meat. Burnt human flesh. I can spend an hour talking about execution. You know, should we be, should we be executing people to begin with? Going with the flavor of the times, where people, where just about everybody agreed with, yeah, let's kill people. Did they deserve what they got? I don't think so. I really don't. I am convinced that there was spying. Yes, I am convinced of it. You got to understand that this occurred right after World War II and in the middle of the Korean conflict. And that's what a lot of this is about. Not so much World War II, but at the end of World War II, what happened to Russia and the following Korean conflict. Quote, the trial of Rosenbergs, the only U.S. civilians ever executed for espionage, was one of the most notorious episodes of the Cold War. Among other things, Julius was accused of persuading his brother-in-law, David Greenglass, a technician at the Los Alamos nuclear lab, to divulge design details for the implosion device needed to trigger the bomb, which were then passed to the Soviets. Now, after a week, after a three-week trial, the Rosenbergs were convicted in March 1951. That's March 29th, folks, and sentenced to death. Now, that's the part that's really hard to take. I understand the conviction. It makes sense to me. But the sentence to death? You know, folks, even then, I mean, it would seem to be, how should I say this, the punishment too far outweigh the crime. I mean, I don't understand it at all. when you consider we carpet bombed Germany. I don't understand. How did the court manage to come to a death sentence? Quote, the verdict predictably outraged the left. Both defendants had been communist in the 30s, but even Pope Pius the 12th made a pitch for clemency. I mean, see how outrageous it was, folks? You got somebody in Rome who's saying, wait a minute, this don't make sense, folks. What are you guys over there doing? Quote, the critics fell into two camps. Some believed the defendants were innocent. Others felt that regardless of guilt, the sentence was too harsh. The authorities unmoved. Their appeals exhausted. The Rosenbergs were electrocuted in June of 1953. Why weren't they moved? What the hell was going on? How could two people, a couple, actually they were an older couple, be executed for that charge and for that what they were found guilty of? I mean, it just doesn't seem to make sense. How did it happen? Quote, belief in the Rosenberg's innocence faded in the 1990s. First, an expanded edition, now this is interesting, of Nikita Khrushchev's memoirs was published, in which the Soviet premier claimed he'd heard a high official tell Stalin that the Rosenbergs had greatly aided Russia's A-bomb push. Of course, you know, again, here, you got to ask the question, these are in Nikita Khrushchev's memoirs. And we're also talking about a third party here, claimed he heard. Well, I got to tell you something about Nikita Khrushchev. He was high on vodka most of the time. What he heard, who knows? But whatever he heard was through a bottle of Russian vodka. However, in 1995, the NSA began to declassify files from the Venona Project, a till then little-known effort to decode Soviet diplomatic cables. The correspondence contained numerous references to nuclear spying by a party, at one point codenamed, you can hear the teeth gnashing, liberal. Can you imagine that? The conservatives at the time, you know, they couldn't resist. So they gave the project the code name Liberal. And abundance of biographical details led inescapably to the conclusion that Liberal was Julius Rosenberg. He was no bit player either. And he was, in fact, a very energetic recruiter for the Soviet cause. But again, does that justify the death penalty? Keep this in mind, folks. We're not asking the question, was he guilty? He was. I don't think there's any question about it. His wife? I doubt it. I think, in fact, they executed an innocent woman who all she was doing was making dinner for her husband. Was Julius guilty? Absolutely. I know no question about it. This man was passing highly classified information to the Russians, but his wife wasn't. If she was involved, it was on the sideline. She probably had no idea what was going on. Still, quote, still, that doesn't mean he and his wife deserved death penalty. True, the Espionage Act of 1917, under which the Rosenbergs were convicted, permitted execution for spying in time of war. Now, keep in mind, there was no war at the time. Hold on, folks. There was the Korean conflict. They never called it a war. But you think it might count for something that during World War II, when the people passed along their ill-gotten secrets, the Soviet Union was an ally. That's right, folks. I bet you probably don't know that. During World War II, the Soviets were part of us. Actually, one of the major defeats for Hitler was he was dumb enough to fight a war on two fronts, and he decided to go into Russia, and this dope did it in the wintertime. Nobody goes into Russia in the wintertime. Back. Quote, for just that reason, the UK was obliged to spare the life of physicist Klaus Fuchs a naturalized British citizen who confessed to giving information from the Manhattan Project and the British nuclear program to the Soviets and was sentenced to 14 years. So this guy was doing exactly the same thing. He gets a 14-year sentence. The Rosenbergs get executed. And the saddest part about the Rosenbergs is his wife. Why she was executed, I'll never know. I don't know how they could possibly make a case against her, but it happened. The U.S. legal team drew no such fine distinctions. Sentencing judge Irving Kaufman blamed the Rosenbergs for the Korean War and said what they'd done was worse than murder. Oh, crap. It most certainly was not. Our carpet bombing was a lot worse than those two could ever do. Come now. We know today that the Soviets obtained aid bomb secrets from multiple sources. Venona files indicate that they had some 350 informants in the U.S. government. Even at the time, it was widely assumed that Fuchs had provided the core technical know-how, with the Rosenbergs providing the details. Actually, some now think the Greenglass info may have given the Russians their first insight into the imploder design. You know, folks, without that imploder design, you cannot detonate a nuclear bomb, at least not in those days. But in the hysterical atmosphere of the early Cold War, the Supreme Court was in the mood to cut the bad guys. We're not in the mood to cut the bad guys any slack. Even if you consider Julius an evil genius, Ethel was at most an accomplice. Prosecutors apparently hoped that leaning hard on Ethel would persuade Julius to talk, but it seemed clear the U.S. was set on making an example of them. To paraphrase philosopher Omar Sharif and Dr. Zhivago, your example, their lives. And that brings up a related question. What about Alger Hiss? You know, he was convicted of lying to a congressional committee in a very equally famous case around 50. Long story short, former communist Whitaker Chambers produced letters and secret government documents he claimed he'd been given in the 30s by Hiss, then a mid-level functionary in the State Department. Here, evidence from the Venona files is less compelling. One decrypted cable refers to a State Department turncoat whose biographical details seem to match Hiss's. The official code name was Ailes, A-L-E-S. Now, you got to understand this, right, folks? Ailes equals Alger. Get the connection? Not necessarily. It was unlike the Soviets to assign their agents code names, so that so closely echoed the real ones. We don't have as much corroboration as in Rosenberg's case, and some still believe Hiss was innocent. I disagree, folks. Hiss was not innocent. He wasn't. I've been through the data. But the weight of evidence suggests he wasn't. I do not buy that. Anyway, it would be unfair to continue reading just one side, because what I've been reading to you is pretty much what I would consider supposedly middle, but maybe not so much. In other words, were they really guilty? Let me go on to the socialistworker.org about the Rosenbergs. Just one or two sentences. Quote, even though the formal indictment against the Rosenbergs was conspiracy to commit espionage, a charge that doesn't carry a death sentence, Kaufman accused them of atomic spying during sentencing. Similarly, he condemned them for treason, which is usually defined as aiding the enemy during wartime. But Russia was an ally of the U.S. Do you understand what's going on here, folks? That the accusation doesn't match what actually happened. Russia was an ally. Russia was not the people we were fighting. Yes, they handed Russia information. But we war with Russia. We're at war with Germany. And from Wikipedia, which you now know I don't trust too much, in 1995, the NSA publicly released documents from the Venona Project, an effort to decrypt intercepted communications between agents and the KGB. Well, there's, according to Wikipedia, there is some controversial question about the Rosenberg case. One, to what extent was Ethel involved? Well, folks, she wasn't. Come on, give me a break. This was a housewife who knew very little about politics to begin with. Were they given a fair trial? Now, there are many critics who have alleged that the political climate of the time and the seemingly a priori belief by Judge Kaufman of their pair's guilt would have made it impossible for the Rosenbergs to have a fair trial. I got to agree with that, folks. Judge Kaufman was out for blood, and he had them guilty before the end of the trial. Was their sentence fair? The imposition of death sentence upon the Rosenbergs has been the most controversial aspect of the case, as they were sentenced far more harshly than any other atomic spies. And why? You got to ask why. The reason that they were executed, folks, is because they refused to confess to their alleged crimes. That's right. Had they pleaded guilty, they may not have been executed. The last question, did they actually help the Russian program? Recent scholarship has suggested that Greenglass and the Rosenbergs actually knew very little about the workings of the atomic weapons, aside from basic concepts that the Russians already had. Well, folks, were they guilty? Do I believe they were? Yes, I do. Do I believe both were guilty? Absolutely not. I think Julius Rosenberg was guilty. I think his wife was simply murdered by us. Should they have been given the death sentence to begin with? How ridiculous. Absolutely absurd. Absolutely absurd. It would not happen today. Nope. It would not happen today. You have to understand that climate of McCarthyism. Well, that was a kind of a long piece on the historical aspects of today. And why did I spend so much time covering it? Because we're entering a phase in our own country of hysteria, national hysteria. Yeah, we are. People are getting hysterical. They don't know what to do. What that means, folks, is when people get frightened, when they get scared, they strike out. They look for scapegoats. What could happen in this country? Well, I would suggest to you that, first of all, we look at the ridiculous immigration law that people are trying to pass, making it a felony to be an illegal alien. That's totally absurd. What are we doing? We're running scared. We don't know how to pay our bills. There's no money left. We're at war all over the planet. None of our soldiers are home. We're running out of money and time. We're running out of oil. One of the things we're not running out of is pollution. We got a lot of that. So a lot of people are getting scared. What happens when people are frightened? They look for a scapegoat. What does that mean for us? It means, folks, eventually, this is going to get racial. You watch. You heard me say it right here. What you are going to see over the next few months, probably the next year or so, is more intense racial hatred between people. Why? They're just frightened people, and they're going to start picking on each other. It's often been said, you can put any 10 people in a room by themselves, and while they may never elect a leader, they sure as hell will pick one out of the 10 to hate. That's what's going on, folks. This is from whatreallyhappened.com. A little bit of old news, and I was going to try to catch up tonight. I may have to do the rest of it tomorrow. I wanted to catch up on some of my old notes. And although they might be a week old, they're important. It's important to hear. Listen to this one, folks. This is in Texas. Texas primary recount was halted by the Secretary of State. You got to understand what's going on. The Texas Secretary of State stepped in to stop the recount of ballots being printed from the Hart Intercivic Electronic Slate, direct record electronic voting machines during a mandated election recount. The stoppage of the recount is due to failure of the voting machines to print all ballots cast during the Texas state primary. That was about 3 to 4 weeks ago. Category? Vote fraud. That's what's going on in Texas, folks. Plain old vote fraud. Texas Secretary of State, he's not going to let him count it. Do you remember when other votes weren't counted? That's how George W. Bush first got in. That's right. And guess who helped him? His brother, the then governor, who may still be governor for all I know. I don't pay that much attention. They didn't count the votes. Why count them? If you don't have to. You know, I got about 2 minutes left here. And I got another thing from what really happened. I'm only going to be able to read part of it, but I'm going to try. It's really kind of cool. The name of it is, I Am Blogger, Hear Me Roar. Quote, the mainstream media has finally acknowledged what has been obvious for quite some time, that the internet weblogs, or blogs, are here to stay. Far from being a passing fad, blogs, like the present one, existed before the word blog was coined to describe them. After nearly 12 years and a readership that exceeds that of most city newspapers, the suggestion that blogs like this one are a passing fancy is at best wishful thinking. Well, you better believe it, folks, especially from the White House. I'm sure they wish the blogs would go away, but it's not going to happen. It is not going to happen. Quote, the mainstream media has long attempted to dismiss blogs as somehow unprofessional, usually because blogs are not vast centers of commerce. Occasionally, there will be a gratuitous hit piece attempting to portray the internet as a haven for child molesters, second only to the clergy. Always there is the implication that blogs should not be taken seriously because the bloggers don't play the game by the same rules as mainstream media. With regard to that last one, it is true that the blogs don't play by the same rules as mainstream media. We have neither governments, owners, nor advertisers imposing rules on us. That's right, folks. That's what separates us out. And guess who else is out? I am out of time. I love you all. Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.